Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
iZotope, Native Instruments, and Plugin Alliance are launching a whole bunch of super hot deals for the Summer of Sound sale. From now until the 6th of July 2023, iZotope are offering all their software for 50% or more off, including the comprehensive mixing and mastering bundle Music Production Suite 5, as well as flagship tools like Ozone, RX, Neutron, and more. All things I use to edit this podcast. Visit iZotope.com and check out the frankly colossal range of things that you can get at extraordinary prices, and take your mixing and editing to a whole new level.
So Matt, there are these two windmills, these big wind turbines in a field. And one of them asks the other, he says, "So what kind of music do you like?" And the other one says, "Well, I'm a big metal fan."
Wait!
Hello, dear listener, and welcome to the Guitar Nerds podcast. This week's dadgad joke was provided by Peter Pesce. Thank you very much, Peter. I thought it was fantastic, seeing as my list has been depleted to only terrible dad jokes from now on.
That was great. That was great.
You sounded enthusiastic there, man.
I'm always enthusiastic. I keep getting it on I think YouTube Shorts. There's two sort of like middle-aged guys that are always like sat completely deadpan, just pulling out a bunch of those random jokes. I'll definitely have to try and remember some next time I see it. Try and add to the collection a little bit more.
Yes, absolutely. It's about time you told a joke on this podcast. Anyway, dear listener, hello and welcome. Welcome to another episode of Guitar Nerds. This week, Matt and I are going to be talking about those new new super complex, advanced, mega digital delay pedals that Boss have done. Including an EVH one. We're going to talk about that. We're going to tie that into the topic of the week that we've been trying to include in an episode for the last few weeks, Rob Nordvik's. And I will do another spin the wheel this week, dear listener, to get a topic of the week for next week from one of our Patreon subscribers. But we're going to try and talk about the evolution of guitar gear from analog to digital, and talk about the advantages and disadvantages of each. Before we do any of that, Dave Grohl looks like he's got an Epiphone signature Trini Lopez thing in the works.
So I'm into this. I remember when they did the Gibson one, and the internet was definitely a thing when we were working in GAC, but there was certainly not as much. I guess YouTube was a thing, but really I only remember Pro Guitar Shop demos. You know, there was less hype. I think less people knew about Joe Bonamassa's gear collection, and, you know, cool, unique Gibsons that were coming out were a bit more like we had to phone the customers and be like, "Oh man, we've got this. It's amazing. Like, have you seen? It's like limited." You know, it wasn't the other way around where people basically just phone it. Like, dealers just have to order it and then someone's going to buy it. And I definitely remember that I had a customer once that he was like a broker for guitar purchases, and he was everywhere. He was like, "I'm desperate to get one of these. I've got so many people that want them. I'm like trying to get as many as possible." And I think even then he had one and was already like flipping it privately for like double the money.
Wow.
And they never, I've never seen one really come up secondhand. Just sort of Google it now. There is one for sale in the UK at Straight Bourbon Music Boutique in Rowlands Gill. I don't even know what idea that is. Very sad to be doing this, but I'm selling my DG335, bought new in 2014, has been played in the house and rehearsal rooms only. £14,999.
I mean, boy, am I glad he took that pound off so that it doesn't say 15,000 at the top. That really sweetens the deal.
I mean, unfortunately, you know, hopefully, I never know. Straight Bourbon Music Boutique might be a listener. So, you know, it's cool that he's, or they have got this guitar, but they are asking for £275 shipping.
Wow. To insure something that's 15 grand, it's going to, you know, I mean, I don't know if that would even cover it, to be honest. I shipped a £6,000, a £6,000, I can't remember what it was. Was it a Gibson? Or was it a Martin? It was a Martin. It was an acoustic of some form that was very expensive. And it was £6,000. And I think that cost me £200 to insure properly with a third party insurer. So, you know, I don't know if that's really going to cover it. But you'd think if you're going to spend £15,000, I mean, unless you're an international buyer, you'd probably make the journey.
I think
paying cash.
Yeah, absolutely. So they did it in three finishes. I definitely think the Pelham Blue came first. They're saying 2007 to 2014. Even Reverb has said this is a rare listing.
What are the other colours then? Black, did the gold and
black and metallic gold,
right?
But Pelham Blue, I think, is the one that most people want. I think that's the one that, I think most people, that's the kind of the colour that he plays, I think.
Yes, yes. He plays the Pelham Blue the most, I guess. The thing that weirds me out is, you know, like a black Gibson ES335, like a good proper one, is like £3,000.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but I think
£12,000 extra for different shaped F holes and a headstock.
Well, you know, you can buy a fake from China with his signature on the back.
Really?
For, oh wow! For $287. I think
you could get a Trini Lopez for £5,000.
Yeah, I think the thing is with this. Is it's very much the Billy Joe Armstrong, Tom DeLonge, you know, Mark Hoppus. It's the signature guitars of guitarists. I mean, you know, all of those people are still big hits with like younger generations of guitar players now.
Sure.
But for people like me and you, Joe, that 15 years ago or you know, when this guitar launched and you might have been massively into Foo Fighters, might be the reason that you play guitar. You could never afford one when it came out. And now you're like mid-30s to mid-40s and, you know, earning a decent wage. You're going to be like, yeah, I'm going to want one, but there isn't any available. So that's just going to push the price up and up.
Yeah,
I think it's that generational thing.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I,
you're totally right.
I think if they make an Epiphone one, I'm going to buy one.
You're going to buy it to flip it, though, Matt.
I'm going to buy it to sit on it for like 20 years, and then
Mark Packham will buy like five and flip them all instantly. He's the king of flipping now, I think.
I think Matt's hot tip here. I generally think this is going to be a really good buy. I think if they do an Epiphone version. To play as a guitar, definitely a cool guitar, but I think in terms of that will never lose value. It'll be like those Joe Bonamassa Firebird ones. That they will just not lose value. Well,
They go for more than they were.
Yeah, and actually, you know, just think about the Billy Joe Armstrong. It's a Les Paul Jr.
Yeah.
Like in terms of like basics, you know, you can't do much less with a guitar.
Yeah,
and you know, they just go for crazy money.
So a point that was raised on the Guitar Nerds group on Facebook when this was posted about this, you know, sort of not leak, but, you know, this unofficial announcement as Dave Grohl's been pictured with an Epiphone version of the DG335. Mm. Someone pointed out, said, I bet, you know, that this is going to be one of those super priced Epiphones that we've been seeing a bit recently. And we have been getting some premium priced Epiphone signature models from various people recently. Mm-hmm. Of course, mm-hmm. you got the Noel Gallagher Epiphone that came out. There's I can't think of any names. Blake Wynan purchased one by someone.
Jim James, that's the new one they've done. That's the guy from My Morning Jacket. I think they did a Gibson Custom Shop version, but they've done an Epiphone version now as well, which is 899.
The Emily Wolf Sheraton, I think that one as well.
Yeah.
We've definitely been seeing some premium priced Epiphones. So what do you think? How much do you think the DG335 is going to be new?
It's a good question, isn't it? Because they could totally be like, we're gonna run these suckers for all the money they've got. It depends, because if these are definitely, I can't imagine these being, because they had the Japanese casinos, Epiphone casinos. Do you remember? They were $1,199.
Yeah. And well, that's what I think this is going to be.
The Noel Gallagher. So I'm like, will it be $1,199 and made in Korea? Or will it be $699? And will they limit supply, or will they go, come on, Foo Fighters? You know, there isn't many bands in the world that can sell out a stadium, let alone, you know, an arena. So I'm just like, you know, you could take the KISS method of selling guitars and literally just pile them on the merch stand and put $1,000 on them, and you'd probably sell 20 or 30 every gig.
Yeah,
you know,
and the rest.
So I don't know. I think I'd like to see it at $899.
I think that's wishful thinking. I'd like to see it at $899. $799? Oh, I'd love that. That would be wonderful.
But I think you're probably right. I reckon $1,199 probably. That's probably where it's going to go, isn't it? I think.
Moog Gravett, friend of the podcast, Moog Gravett. He's a big Foo Fighters fan. I wonder if he's going to buy one. Let us know, Moog. Are you planning on picking one up?
Maybe we need like some sort of pool. We'll all chip in, and then, you know, I'll have it on Mondays. You have it on Tuesdays.
Oh, yeah, that's
and then
a great idea.
We'll just take it from there.
That is a good idea. Well, we'll see. Obviously, we're yet to get an official announcement, so we're waiting to see to see what occurs.
Take it from there.
Matt, I have had a super hectic week. I've had loads of gigs. I went to see Choda Koo and Nordic Giants play a very small show at Brighton Electric. That was very good. Dear listener, I've spoken about Choda Koo in the past. I think Charlie Barnes, the guitarist in Choda Koo, is absolutely fantastic. Plays a Teddy with a strap neck through a Fender Twin. His only drive pedal is a Proco Rat, which he always runs on batteries. And
for the tones.
Yeah, exactly. He just has such a simple setup, and it's always so fantastic. So that was really good. And I went to Portals Festival in London at Earth in Hackney. I don't know if you've ever been to Earth.
No, I think we were talking about it off podcast at one point, weren't we? And
probably.
Was gutted I couldn't go, actually, because it looked like some good bands this year.
Oh, fantastic bands. Orange sponsored the festival, so it's chock full of Orange amplifiers. Mm. But yeah, it's some, you know, I saw some amazing stuff. Jambonai, this fantastic band that play like a sort of almost heavy post rock with traditional Asian folk instruments. Except for their guitarist, who's playing who's the Deftones guy? It's Stephen Carpenter.
Oh, yeah. Which one? The 8-string baritone?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that one. Yeah. I think so. Anyway, I was quite far away, but I'm pretty sure that's what it was. It definitely was one of his guitars. His ESP? It's ESP that make that, isn't it?
Yeah. Actually, funny enough, I've been listening to quite a lot of Deftones recently, and I was like, oh, man. He does have just a crazy... It's sort of, in some ways, a bit like Mush, because right. he's like got these huge chords and he's doing like, it's on an 8-string baritone. It's right. so low. But yeah, it just, yeah, it does fill out that sound very much. But I think they did an 8-string baritone in Pink.
Oh, yes. Point. I think I remember this very, very...
Yeah, ESP Steph B8CS, Stephen Carpenter in satin pink. And it's got those two Fishman Fluence pickups like in the middle.
yeah, they're right next to each other in the middle. It's weird pickup placing, but it is cool. It does look good.
I know. It's just, I just think it's great. I definitely, it's just so tuned so low, but I'd absolutely play one of those. It's wicked.
Yeah, they are a great guitar.
He's actually got a lot of signature guitars. They do a baritone Tele style, then a couple of...
Yeah, the Tele's the one that I'm more familiar with, but yeah. Of course it's the SC607 and 608, which is the more normal Strat-shaped version of that guitar.
Yeah, I think they do like a cheap one, then they do one with two humbuckers and a single coil. Anyway,
they're great. ESP do make some great guitars. They recently got the other Slipknot guitarist on board.
Mick Thompson
came across from Jackson.
Jackson, yeah, he's played Jackson since day one. I always remember him sort of playing Jackson guitars. So yeah, moving over to ESP. I'm actually going through ESP's catalog now, and I'm like, yeah, we definitely don't talk enough about ESP, I guess, like, because they, you know, they are generally geared towards maybe a guitarist that we probably don't talk about, but you know, they had those E2 series quite a few years ago now, and I remember when we talked about them on the podcast when they first launched, and they were the ones that are made in Japan. But that the TE series they do some quite cool. Yeah, they do a 6 or 7 string baritone Tele style with two humbuckers in. I remember for a while as well, at one point when I was at GAC, we had an ESP Viper bass. Do you remember them?
I do remember. You're talking about the custom shop one that was made. It was an ESP Viper, which is the Viper's the SG style shape, almost an offset SG. And it had a big 8-pole Music Man pickup, but bang in the middle of the body. If you remember, because that was when me and Krista were running the bass department.
Yeah.
And we had, for a brief point in time, we put all the second-hand basses, as that was, on the far wall, right next to the staircase that led up to where we kept all the cases. And one day, someone dropped a case down that staircase, and it took a massive chunk out the side of that Viper.
And, did it?
Yeah, so hey, whoever bought it got a great deal on account of that. But they are good, you know what? Even, like, the LTD stuff, it was always such high quality. And I'm looking now, I'm on their website, looking at like the SN series and the TE series, which is kind of their, I guess, more traditional Strat and Tele style guitars. I mean, they make some great stuff. I'm a big fan of the SN 1000HT, which is like a fire blast finish. So it's like, do you remember those? I never liked them when Fender did it, but do you remember the sandblasted finishes?
Oh, I always thought they were cool because didn't they do a Jim Root sandblasted at one point?
Oh, did they? I don't remember. I mean, it would suit that guitar for sure. I only remember them doing Strats and Teles. But yeah, the sandblasted thing.
I'm sure they did a sandblasted. Yeah, they did. They did a limited edition sandblasted Jim Root Jazz Master, which was like black and red, which was very cool. I still think those Jim Root Jazz Masters, I'm like, yeah, I'll play one of those. I think they're cool looking guitars, those. But just on ESP, you've never seen anything like going to Big Boss in, I think it's Big Boss in Ochanomizu in Japan, where they basically have the custom shop in there, and it's like a whole section of the store with just like a desk and then like all the bits of wood, and then you can basically just completely custom spec your own ESP, and it's all custom made and handmade to order. And they also have some like ESPs that you've just never seen.
They make so much stuff, don't they? That's the thing. There's so much ESP that sort of goes under the radar.
Yeah, well, especially in Japan, there's a huge market for it in Japan. And because they have a lot of like virtual bands and stuff like that that you don't have like here. And they all have like signature guitars and like all this sort of signature stuff. I'm sure we've talked about it before, but one of the really big, like, I don't know what they call them. I guess, character bands, like cartoon characters. One of the biggest ones in Japan is a girl band called Bang Dream.
Okay.
And they have their own signature ESPs.
Wow. So they don't exist. They're not real, but they have
their own signature ESPs.
Great.
Which is pretty mad. Although I've just found a picture of them, and one's playing a White Falcon and one's playing a Rickenbacker. So, clearly they can go wherever they want in the world of signatures. But yeah, interesting. Although actually saying that, it looks like ESP in Japan might also distribute Floyd Rose, Seymour Duncan, Italia, and Lackland basses.
Oh, well, how about that?
But they also have Navigator and Edwards and Grassroots, which are three brands you basically don't see anywhere outside of Japan.
You never get... I like a good Edwards. You know, the Edwards are like these cool sort of high quality... They're ESPs, but they say Edwards on them for some
reason. I don't know why. I don't know what the story is there.
Me neither. Which we should know. We're supposed to be
I know. But because you had a couple, didn't you? You had that great... Didn't you have an Edwards Les Paul at one point?
No. The only Edwards thing I ever had was a jazz bass, actually, that came through. It was very lovely. It was one of my favorite, close to my favorite Gibson color, which his name escapes me, a red. Help me out.
Candy apple red.
No. Come on. It's a flat cardinal red. There we go. In the end. Yeah. It was... which is a great color, and I was a big fan of that guitar. But yes, ESP, great brand.
How did we get to ESP? How did we get to ESP, Joe?
I
think
remember.
We were talking about portals, and then we somehow went to Stephen Carpenter, and then we went to ESP.
Exactly. But anyway, so I was in London for that, so I popped into Denmark Street on the way back. Didn't have very much time. I had to catch a train, so I just went into One Joe's and I went into Hank's. Emma was like, "You got time for maybe like a glance around two shops?" So I hadn't been to Hank's in ages, so I went in there, checked out loads of stuff. Oh, they have such cool, weird things. Loads of Echoes, loads of like weird old rocker switch control based 60s stuff from like England and Italy and all the countries that were sort of trying to imitate what America was doing at that, you know, sort of 50s, 60s point in time, but weren't quite hitting the nail on the head. It's loads of cool things like that. And I got to try out a fretless Guild B302 because I'm on the hunt for a new fretless at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
It's very, very lovely. Problem with it was it's an unlined fretless, which is fine if you're playing jazz, but if you're playing a rock and roll band and you're moving around a lot on stage and you're playing with a loud band, it's very difficult sometimes to hear if you're in or out. So the lines do really help. Especially when you think without lines, the gap between the first and the third fret, that's a lot of space. And you've only got the dots on the side. So trying to get your second fret on the money can be a little bit of an effort.
Just use a vibrato all the time. You're always slightly out.
That's the solution. But, you know, I didn't get anything because I've got that. We talked about it last week. I got that. Refinished Warwick Streamer at the moment, part of their rock based series, which, dear listener, are very affordable. The budget single pickup Warwick Streamer. I will say, guitarists out there, you know, we always talk about the Broncos and things like that, but man, you want something simple and playable. They are extremely playable, great necks, you know, kind of small, more tailored towards, you know, I guess a guitarist's hands in that sense. But the one I've got, as I think we did mention, has been retrofitted with a Guild Bisonic pickup, the the BS-1, poorly named slightly maybe, but the Guild BS-1 Bisonic pickup, which is a $99 pickup, dear listener, if you want to buy it. I think it might be the perfect modding pickup for bass. It's so affordable and it sounds absolutely fantastic. It can turn something like, you know, this very modern Warwick into a great sort of tight but vintage sounding P bass. I recorded a little demo of me playing the Warwick. This is just the Warwick. I recorded two lines of bass. One's just doing some high stuff in the background to pad it out with a little drum loop going. But listen to this tone for something that's a very affordable setup.
Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There it is. Oh, I think that's a great... There is nothing
that's
like I'm
a great
using...
Sound.
It is a great sound. I'm using a simple Plugin Alliance SVT plugin, and there's a little bit of the stock Studio One free fat compressor on the end of that. That's it.
Yeah. I think it sounds really good.
Yeah.
It's always nice to explore something a little bit different on the old bass front there, Mr. Joe.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But dear listener, you know, if you're a bass player or you're, you know, thinking about something for bass, I can't recommend enough just that Bisonic pickup. Put it in whatever you've got. It's great. It is great. Now, Matt, we said we're going to talk about Rob Nordvik's topic of the week.
Yes.
I want to get into that.
Let's get into it?
Let's get into that. Now, very quickly before we do, we should spin the wheel so that we can find out who's going to be choosing our topic of the week for next week. So let's spin the wheel. There we go, dear listener. And this week's winner is actually someone whose question we were going to potentially talk about a little bit later. Is Robin Smith. Well done, Robin Smith. You are this week's victor. We'll be in touch and you can let us know what you'd like us to talk about on next week's episode.
Lovely.
Yeah. Very lovely. So Rob Nordvik wanted us to talk about the evolution of guitar gear from analog to digital, including the advantage and disadvantages of each. Because I guess much like fashion, we're going through, you know, it swings and roundabouts, isn't it? We have the original gear, and then the 80s happened, and maybe by today's standards, we'd consider those first forays into digital gear vulgar or tasteless, maybe slightly. I'm not saying that they were all bad. I'm just saying they were a little bit all or nothing. And then we've had this sort of move back into vintage gear and valve stuff. And that's been pretty strong, certainly the whole time that Matt, you and I have been working in guitar shops. But now we're seeing great innovations. Obviously, things like GT by Boss, things like Helix, they've changed the game. And then having access to things like Katana, Mustang, you know, yeah, you know, things like Katana, things like Mustang, they've all made that sort of thing available to people at an affordable price point. You can't discount things like the Positive Grid Spark, you know, at a very affordable level.
Well,
giving
yeah.
people access to that stuff. And
I think,
yeah,
you know, one of the biggest evolutionary jumps, or maybe it's not an evolutionary jump, but one of the biggest things we're seeing now, you know, is a move away from even, you know, if you've got high-end effects processing, so, yeah, GT1000, Line 6 Helix, more flagship Quad Cortex, but you're moving away from even having a physical piece of hardware with a processor and a chip in it and actually just having it all on your computer. Like, yeah. there's nothing more digital than effectively plugging your guitar into a computer and hearing it through monitors. And we are really a generation of players now that can try all of that gear from 1959, 1950, you know, the early guitars, guitar pedals, all the way through to, you know, plugging into a computer and having a piece of software do right. everything for you.
Yeah.
It's pretty bad, really, when you think about.
Well, and also how having long access
that
time's to
spin, really.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, I totally interrupted you halfway through a sentence.
No, I was just, you know, you think only 120 years ago did the first plane take off, and, you know, only 60 years ago did someone make the first guitar pedal.
Yeah.
You know, you've gone from Ain't No Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones to.
Think of a song, a modern song.
No, I was trying to think of a song by that band that everyone likes with
Meshuggah.
Polyphia. But yeah. I couldn't name you one Polyphia song.
They probably can't.
which again is, you know, it's, I guess, no, you, a better example, and the one I always think about is, yeah, you've gone from Ain't No Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones to a guitarist like Pliny, who when we interviewed him a few years ago was like, yeah, I've never plugged into an amp.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Matt, you know, we're at a time where people are getting signature plugins, like Rabea having his own neural DSP amplifier and effects pedal set.
And it's not based off anything. I mean, obviously there's ideas and inspirations, but it's not like here's a boogie and here's a, it is, you know, here's three amps that cover his sound and style. So, yeah, I think it's really interesting. And it does, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about the, don't want to talk about them just now, but, you know, the new Boss SD3000, you know, and talking about the history of the 3000 rack unit, which came at the, I guess, the birth of digital technology or digital technology starting to make its way into the world of guitars. And, you know, they were developing that before commercial CD players were available, you know, but, you know, CDs hadn't even, CD players, you couldn't really buy one at an affordable price, you know, think companies like Sony and that were talking about all of that, you know, and that made that massive jump to 12-bit, you know, and it just seemed insane at that point.
Yeah.
And I think what's really interesting is that products like that were half digital and half analog, you know, so there was still a level of analog that had to be built into that circuit and that design. And then you had sort of like digital control over certain parts of it, but analog control over other bits,
right?
You know, and then that slowly, I guess, for me, I always feel that digital technology was moved forward by obviously lots of people innovating new technologies that were available to them. You think about DX7, you know, everyone had analog synths, and then Yamaha was like, oh, here's a completely different digital synthesizer. And it became like one of the most popular synths ever. And I guess really it just moved, people used it, it became popular, so that pumped enough money back into people to try and one up it and do something better. But I was reading something interesting. I can't remember where it was, an article about delay pedals. And, you know, for the longest time, you know, obviously you had like DD3 was pretty dominant. You had like other digital compacts. But it wasn't until DL4 came along in 2000
right.
that really changed the game in terms of like, here's what you could, here's multiple digital delays in one box
yeah.
with some presets. Like, no one had ever seen anything like that before. And I think that then spurs on this infighting within the industry to like create one better or do something different or innovate or, you know,
absolutely.
Whatever. You know, I think that's where evolution really comes from. Yes, technology plays a part in it, but I think it's also people just trying to outdo each other in the industry, really.
Definitely. And that's certainly where I agree that that's where digital is progressing. You know, these days we're seeing companies like Chase Bliss really at the forefront of that. Maybe Game Changer as well, if nothing else, just for originality in how they're approaching making pedals. But here's like as a slight counter, not really a counter, but the other side of it, digital stuff, the DL4 is actually the... is the argument against what I'm about to say. But did digital stuff really get enough of a hold in the industry before it started trying to imitate analog stuff?
Yeah,
you know, before you look at a digital delay, the idea was they were like, here's a delay where the tails don't get muddy sounding. You know, we've improved some things. But, and I appreciate people wanted that at the time, but I think where all this gear has really exploded is digital gear imitating unobtainable analog gear.
Mm.
And the whole modeling world, that's what's brought digital gear back. The fact that on a Helix, I can get a clone. Yeah, and I appreciate, dear listener, there are lots of clones out there. But, you know, it's that I can get, that was maybe, the clone's maybe a bad example. But with that Helix, I can have a clone and maybe, I think they do a DM2 style delay on there. And I can run that into a Fender Twin. And, you know, it's the modeling side that has made digital stuff really very popular again now, because it's not just for the nerds who want a digital delay pedal because it can do all this ridiculous ping pong stuff. It's now for almost the analog purists as well. They've got options there.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I know when I've had conversations with engineers and stuff before, and certainly from like a Roland perspective, there was always an effort to try and iron out the issues with previous products, because those things were seen as, you know, improvements. So, you know, right. Digital delay came along because, you know, if you look at tape was bulky, tape delays were expensive, they had physical parts that would wear out like tape, they might sound different from night to night, and it's the same with analog synths, you know, and they have to warm up, or any analog gear. So digital gear allowed it a much more consistent and controlled approach. And then obviously as processors got better, you know, you could iron out the cleaner sounds and the headroom and the dynamic range. And then I guess, yeah, as modeling came along, now Boss were the first company to do modeling, and certainly in a multi-effects, you know, composite object sound modeling. And yeah, then it allowed them to go, okay, well, we can capture the sounds, or we can take the sounds of old products. And it's funny, isn't it? You wouldn't have thought that you would necessarily spend 1,500 quid on a Helix to mimic an analog delay pedal from 40 years ago that, in the eyes of perhaps an engineer, sounds not as good as the other product that you're plugging into.
Yeah.
I guess really what probably helped modeling technology, analog technology, is the desire for hard to find older gear. You know, everyone right. makes a clone because everyone wants a clone.
Yeah.
You know, analog or digital. So I guess it's because I think if people had just gone, no, that is in the past and we don't want that,
yeah,
then what would be the point of modeling?
stuff. I guess because we are still, I mean, we're still, like, as you pointed out when we started talking about this, we're very close still as a human race to the dawn of rock and roll and electric instruments. This is the first time, what we're experiencing now is the first time that vintage gear has been coveted, because it's the first time vintage gears existed. You know, what were Boss's first six stomp boxes? 1977?
Yeah.
And that's not very long ago.
Well, I think as well, and I've sort of take my dad's stance on this because I think it's quite relevant, because he's into classic cars. And for him, you know, he's 73. A classic car to him was a car that was cool when he was into cars, you know, from the 40s or the 50s, you know. Right. But once you got, if you were then born in the 70s or the 80s, you know, a cool car to you would be like something that was cool at that period.
Yeah.
And, you know, for people now, it's a totally different thing. And, you know, kids who are growing up now are looking at, like, mega fast sports cars, a car from 1930s looks really old and outdated. And I think guitars are actually probably at that point, because I was looking at, we've talked about this before, but American Standard Strats from 2000, going, how are they £1,500? They're more money now than they were when we were selling them at GAC.
Yeah.
And I think it's because I look at it and go, you know what? What guitar I miss? I missed my first American Strat, and it was a 2001 American Strat. And I said, if I'm going to buy something now that's affordable, I'm going to buy, yeah, I could buy a 60s Strat, but I'm like, they're a lot of money. They're too much money for me and for 99% of the people out there.
Also, much longer are they going to last? We are at that point. Can you really gig a 60s instrument? I know my 69 P bass stays in a case. I'm going to set it because I can't gig it. It's not reliable.
Yeah, and I just think, like, there's probably going to get to a point where, you know, are people growing up? I don't know, because you've still got people like Slash, or people are still into Stevie Ray Vaughan or Jimi Hendrix, you know, and they were playing these old Strats or old Les Pauls, you know. But there's going to get to a point where, you know, we're talking about that Stephen Carpenter guitar, you know, people are getting to Deftones now that they're like 12 years old, and then 20 years time, like, I want one of those. That guitar's going to be 20 or 30 years old at that point. Right. Is that going to be more desirable than a 59 Les Paul? If you're not into metal, like 59, you know, if you're into Polyphia and modern tech metal, are you going to be into a 59 Les Paul? No, you're going to want a Tim Henson signature. So that guitar becomes irrelevant. So I wonder if there will be a point where that generation of people just get beyond that. Oh. And then a new range of guitars or something, and a new range of technology becomes desirable, and people go, I want stuff from the 90s, not stuff maybe.
Well, hopefully we'll all just forget about the 90s. But I really hope that you're wrong. I hope that it's not the case, because I hope it doesn't matter that we're moving forward. I kind of disagreed with you on the cars. I still think that, you know, an Aston Martin DB4 is a classic car, but that happened 25 years before I was born. And, you know, so it wasn't cool at the time, but that is a great classic car. A great, you know, vintage guitar is still a 51 Telecaster, you know. Hopefully that's not going to change, because that was the dawn of rock and roll, just like those cars were the dawn of fast automobiles.
Yeah,
you know, hopefully that always stays. It's the origin period, not a set amount of time from when you're born. Hopefully people carry on thinking that, you know, the dawn of rock and roll is a coveted time period where people were making awesome stuff with the gear that was available to them. But you know, who knows?
It's difficult, isn't it? Because the more people, you know, there's always this constant thing about you're seeing less and less valve amps, and you know, do I think valve technology is probably going to die in the next 10 years? No, 20, maybe starting to see less, 30, 50. But there'll always be people who want it. I think it's just new players help drive that technology forward, because they're the people that adopt it.
Yeah. Well,
because that's what's available to them, isn't it?
Well, Matt, you know, I think the thing that drives it are famous bands, big players. And, you know, there are people out there like Joe Bonamassa, sure, but I would suggest that most big bands actually care about reliability. That's their number one thing. And with digital stuff getting as good as it is, obviously we've already seen tech metal and metal bands really, go in for using digital stuff and plugins and things like Helix for live. They've dominated that scene, and ampless stages are everywhere. There's sort of this core like rock and roll and indie rock that's still using real amplifiers. How long will that hold on for if valve amps are getting harder to repair, harder to find a repair person for, and you've got great solutions from the digital world? I think we've spoken about this on the podcast, but the conversation I always have with Dave Green at Ashdown, he's the designer at Ashdown, he doesn't like digital gear because it's not repairable. When it goes wrong, it's not like you can have it repaired. So there's a slight sense of maybe there being a bit of false economy with digital gear, in that once it breaks, you've got to buy a new one. Whereas when, you know, something transistor breaks, you have it repaired.
I guess that's the unfortunate thing that we live in today about throwaway technology, isn't it? It's like people are used to buying a new phone every year or every 2 years.
Yeah.
People are used to buying a new multi-effects every year or, switching plugins every 5 minutes, something new comes out. And you almost get this point where no one sticks to anything because everyone's always trying to try the latest thing. I totally get that because people, they're not as there's less of that right to repair,
right?
It's like, oh yeah, it breaks, you can't repair it, sorry, okay, I'll just, it's easier if £150 non-valve amp breaks to just probably buy another £150 valve, solid state or modeling amp than it is to go and get it repaired. Which is terrible. Terrible for the environment.
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah. It's so ridiculous. It's the most hypocritical thing I think about our generation, Matt, and me included. Like, I do half my shopping at Hisbees, which, dear listener, if you're not from Brighton or Worthing, you probably don't know what that is, but it's one of those supermarkets, a waste-free supermarket. So you bring your own containers.
Right.
Like, I have some, I have a contract with recycled toilet paper that gets delivered. Everything I have in my life, like I'm vegan, for goodness sake, everything I have in my life is so, I'm always thinking about eco stuff and all of that. Yet when it comes to gear, we buy all this digital stuff that we can't fix. It just goes into landfill when it breaks. It's sort of the absolute reverse of everything else. So I think as a generation, we're quite, eco-minded in general. Everyone's thinking about their carbon footprint and waste and things like that. Yet, when it comes to digital gear, we get the latest phone and we buy a new unrepairable digital thing.
I think what's interesting, and I think I'm at that point now, is that, and I think everyone gets to this point, talking about the evolution of gear, is you get to a point where you just don't take that next step. For me, plugins were just a step beyond what I was willing to get into or enjoy or use. So now everything that probably comes post plugin is just like too much for me. Do you know what I mean? I'm just like, no, that's it. I'm going backwards and not forwards. And I guess everyone probably gets to that point where they're I'm not going to upgrade my phone and I'm going to stick to my computer that's 10 years old because it works.
Yeah. Our parents got to that point with sat navs or phone maps. They'll still insist on telling you the way to go to somewhere, even though you can look it up on your phone and that way avoid traffic. Every generation gets to that point where they're like, I know it's available, I know the information is available, but I'm done. I'm stopping here.
I think what's great though is in the last 20 years, what what's evolved in the world of pedals has been companies like Chase Bliss,
yeah,
who have kind of gone, analog heart, digital brains. Like, actually, right, how, a circuit's a circuit. Like, the components, sure, you put in, like, people aren't necessarily, I would say for fairly certain, but I'm sure that there's not many people out there making new capacitors or new resistors or designing, yeah, new ways to build a circuit necessarily. Like, the circuit designs are what's out there. What's changing is you're getting companies like that who are digitally controlling analog tech, or you're getting an improvement in DSP coding. So yes, you're getting more powerful processors, like, stuff that's coming out from Boss is 32-bit 96K, and you've got more headroom and less latency. But it's the programming, the DSP, everything that goes into creating the sound or the algorithm, that's sort of evolving guitar pedals now. Yes, you're getting lots of new cool analog circuits or new takes on analog circuits, but there's certain companies, I think, like Chase Bliss, who are taking it up a level in terms of, like, programming and algorithm design, because that's not modeling anything, but that's creating, like, new types of sound, new types of,
yeah,
effect. Hologram Electronics with the Microcosm is another one, I think, that granular looper delay type thing, and programming these new cool algorithms to create new music. That's what's, I think that's what's evolving in the guitar effect world.
Yeah, definitely. That's what's pushing things forward. I mean, on that note, Matt, that's quite a good segue for us to talk about Boss doing exactly that with the most computery, futuristic looking.
The DeLorean.
The SDE-3000D and 3000 EVH.
So the SDE-3000, the rack unit originally, which was in 1983, designed by Yoshi Kagami, who was the president of Boss. He originally was the lead engineer on that. So they wanted to use digital technology to create a delay that was more stable, more portable, the ultimate delay sound, right, to take the next evolution from RE-201, I guess. You think we made RE-201 from 1977 to 1991.
Yeah.
Or 1990.
Desperate to bring out something new to replace it by that.
So, from, 1977 to 1983, that's only 6 years. But you think in those years, what you did have is you had the evolution from tape to analog. So the creation of the BBD, the Bucket Brigade device, the way to basically make a delay sound with a small chip, so you didn't need tape. But at the same time, yes, digital technology was becoming a thing. So they could digitally control elements of the circuit, like, the clock, for example, to control and have a much more consistent delay time, add in things like, memories. Didn't have a delay with memories. How could you, how could you do that? So it was all of those sort of ideas. But it was originally a rack unit, a mono rack unit. So a lot of players ended up using two, so they could run them in stereo, because you effectively, just set them to the same delay time on the screen, and then you would run them, or you would run them slightly out, but you'd have a big stereo sound. If you think 83, going into that point of like stadium rock and big, refrigerated rack units, and all of the session people started using them, and it definitely had that sound of what we would class now as vintage digital, like 12-bit digital delay sounds.
Vintage digital, definitely.
So vintage digital. And it's that mixture of a part analog, part digital circuit that created the magic of that sound. Because, yes, you had modulation, but you also had a small amount of modulation in the clock signal in the unit itself, which, even though it's not like jumping up and down 10, 15 milliseconds, there's a slight movement in that signal, which creates a warmth and ambience with that sound, but also the kind of airy, high dynamics of the way it was built and designed. It just has a really great sound that just sits in a mix. But obviously, it's been discontinued since the early 90s, you know, because obviously things started to pick up speed and we could make, you know, we made the DD2 in 1985, so a couple of years after, you know, taking the same chip that's in the SDE, fits perfectly into a compact, the birth of the first ever compact digital delay pedal. People are like, don't need a rack, don't need a, you know, don't need a tape, and I've got a digital delay pedal that sounds exactly the same every time I turn it on. But, you know, fast forward to now, there's lots of famous users who still use SDEs, still in the studio. Right. You'll still see them in studio racks everywhere. Oh, yeah. And it does have a sound. They don't go for tons of money. But, you know, they are, you know, most people would buy them and run two of them and run them in pairs. So, you know, like what we did with the RE202 last year, we wanted to bring that sound into a modern day pedal. So rather than just going, okay, well, we're going to stick a digital delay in a box, there's loads of digital delays out there. As I said, everyone used to run them in stereo pairs. So we put not one, but two sets of stereo pairs in one box. So effectively, you have DDL1 and DDL2. You can turn those on and off independently. And right. each one of those is a stereo pair of SDE 3000s. So if you're running it in stereo, you effectively have four delay lines that you can run in stereo, or you can run wet dry, you can run one delay into another, you can run series or parallel. And it mimics and recreates all of the options of the original, as well as some other stuff as well for modern day, you know, the fact that you've got MIDI and everything on there. But I have to say, I've got the 3000D on my pedal board.
Right.
And it is just, there's a magic sound to it that is so difficult to explain, but it just works. It just sits in a mix. It's absolutely just perfect.
A lot of buttons.
Exactly the same topology as the original rack. Unit. We didn't want to change that. And also, again, old units, like we did the RE202, we took seven of the original units and then like took elements from all of those to kind of come up with a comprehensive sound in a box that sounded like, you know, a wide range of all of those units. But effectively, you've got time, feedback, output level, modulation rate, modulation depth, and then on the front, you can filter the delay by hitting the filter button. You can double the delay time by hitting the times two button. Then you can invert the phase of either the guitar signal or the feedback, the repeats. Right. So that's really handy when you're running two, because you can invert the phase of one or the other. So you get a lot of different cross-modulation sounds, and then you've got a modulation button that turns the modulation on and off.
Obviously, I understand why you've done it to keep the topology the same as the rack unit, but it's funny to see also the time, feedback, you know, rate and depth controls, those standard delay controls that I'd expect to be on a rotary, instead being on a little rocker switch.
Yeah, there as well. Yeah, and actually, I much prefer it, because once you get used to it, it's so quick to just dial it in exactly how you want it.
I see.
And, you know, I thought the interesting story was at that time was the reason they did it that way on the rack units was at the time, everyone who was using rack units, everything just had red LEDs. So from the back of the stage, or if you're in the audience, you couldn't tell what people were using. So they wanted to do it in blue with a screen so that when you saw it behind someone on stage, you knew they were using a Boss product.
Very smart.
And I was like, that's genius. And I like the fact that we've kept it the same. And actually, I like the buttons. You know, rotary is great, but it's not as precision as this, and it really allows you to dial those in. So it's amazing. Stereo in, stereo out, all the features you'd expect from a modern digital delay product, but it has a magic sound to it that, it's unlike anything else. And you can even get things like chorus and flanges out of it as well, depending on how you play around with the
filtering
and stuff. which is very cool. But one of the most famous users of a stereo pair of SDEs was Eddie Van Halen. And he ran a complete, like, wet, dry, wet, so 3 amps, and then splitting the two SDEs out in stereo. We basically made...
That's such an ultimate setup.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's definitely, out of everything I've said today, I urge anyone to just go, if you haven't watched the videos that Boss put out online, because the stories are amazing. But yeah, he basically ran a 3-amp setup, and we wanted to do a version that people who wanted that sound and wanted to run that rig could. So it's a more ultimate version of the 3000D, in the fact that it allows you to run a fully wet, dry, wet setup. So you can run 3 amps. And then it's also got an effects loop on it as well. So you can run it 7-cable method. So you can have the preamp from the dry amp and then run out into those 2 stereo amps, or you can have your own distortion pedal. And it's got 4 of his actual presets as well, from his actual units. So, you know, certainly for people who are into Van Halen, will want to run a big, even bigger rig, then there's a Van Halen version as well, which is very, very cool.
Well, that is, that is very full on. This is a very comprehensive digital delay pedal.
Actually, Joe, we should perhaps leave it there, and you should create a backing track. And maybe I should just do some sounds over the top of it, to give people a little bit of a flavor.
Week after next, we'll get back to everyone on that. We'll do some of Matt's playing
samples. I'll try and do a bunch of different sounds just using that. But yeah, honestly, I would say to everyone, it's like, you haven't played or heard a delay pedal that sits quite like this in your guitar sound. It's really, really stunning.
Very, very cool indeed. Now, that is the question duck letting us know that, well, in fact, it is actually almost time for the end of this podcast. But when Matt and I finish, we're going to be heading over to patreon.com/guitar nerds, where each week we record an extra episode where we talk about questions or topics that have been mentioned in the Guitar Nerds group on Facebook. This week, Josh Chudley had bought he had a bass rig. He's looking to upgrade. He was looking for suggestions on that. So we might talk a little bit about that, because he was interested in the Boss Katana 210. So we might talk around that a little bit. A few weeks ago, I started talking about Marshall and the fact I've never really owned one. I really would like to. You guys sent me loads of suggestions. I'm going to talk about the app that I'm going to go for out of that range. John Mahon is doing a board rejig, and he's looking for an ideally dual drive and boost recommendation. So we might talk about that. Now, I've been meaning the last few weeks to do this, suggested by one of the listeners. I don't remember who. I think it might be Peter Pesci, the same fellow who gave me the joke at the start of this week's episode. He suggested doing a listener's gear of the week, and I've been meaning to do it, and it just keeps, you know how it is, dear listener. We go off on one and forget where we are. But I might talk a little bit about, I saw Sam Brooksby on the Facebook group sharing that he'd bought an EVH Wolfgang, and then there were a bunch of comments of other people with EVH Wolfgang saying, yeah, great guitar, amazing value for money. Just never something I've ever talked about. Like, sure, they were guitars we sold at GAC, but I never gave them a second look. So maybe Matt and I will talk around those. And of course, there are lots of different iterations by different brands of that type of guitar. So we could talk around those a little bit. And maybe some other bits, but we'll see. We'll see what we get time for. But yeah, we're going to go over and do that now. So, dear listener, thank you very much indeed for listening again to another week's episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast. Hop over to patreon.com/guitar nerds. It's got all the info there on how you can sign up and support our charming community. And I'll be back. Matt, you've got a week off next week. So
I have indeed.
You have indeed. So I'll be back with a guest on next week's episode for more of this guitar nerdery. Farewell.
Goodbye.
Well, that's it for another week of the Guitar Nerds podcast, which only leaves me to say thank you eternally and very, very muchly to all of our top tier Patreon backers. Thank you very much to Marcus Deluxe, Suresh, Dorsonic Pickups, Chris Franklin, Anton Fryant, Russ Meehan, Barry Gresbick, Steve Davis, Daniel Walker, Jorin Brown, John Conway, The Studio Rats, Russell Healing, Yogi the Guitarist, Ty Allen, Kyle Harris, Sean Hughes, Andy Hoffler, Eric Hemmer, Jeffrey Wax, Brian Einsler, Mark Hisiao Kaduaki, Stuart Robson, Eric File, Peter Pesce, Andy Manley, Joe Patek, Blake Weiland, Phil Radomski, Dave Lee, Ross Edwards, Jason Wharton, James Dorr, Jake Gray, Derek Rich, Scott Kennedy, Steve Merkel, Abe Matthews, Christopher Losef, Stephen Burke, Robin Smith, Kytopia the Band, JD Short, Andy McKenzie, Brad Page, Paul Corrigan, Rob Nordvik, Scott O'Brien, and the wonderful Moog Gravitt.